The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and I'm excited about today's show about the resilient family. There's an awful lot of doom and gloom out there for families to contemplate. With persistent national and personal debt, shrinking resources around the world, climate change, malnutrition alongside of obesity, and adjustments in the very concept of family. And families are feeling the stress of constant change. Fortunately, there is hope in the form of contemporary grassroots movements, according to my guest this week on Family First, James H. Lee. In his new book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life, he shows how these movements can restore self-reliance and community engagement and actually propel us into a more positive society. He'll discuss how families can take control of their own destiny and help to create the future they want for their children and their grandchildren. James H. Lee is a Delaware-based financial advisor who engages in extensive research and analysis of emerging technologies and social trends. During his 20-year career, his system has identified numerous investment opportunities for his clients. He's the author, as I said, of Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life, and it's a really worthwhile book. He has been interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, Financial Planning, and Medical Economics. He's also written for The Futurist, the Journal of Future Studies and Technology Forecasting and Social Change. He's a popular blogger for the World Future Society and has presented at their annual conference. He's also a member of the Association of Professional Futurists. Lee graduated from the College of William & Mary with a BA in economics and earned a master's degree in studies of the future from the University of Houston at Clear Lake. He's a certified financial planner, a chartered financial analyst, and a chartered market technician. And welcome to our show, James.
Terrific. Thank you very much. It is delightful to be here.
Great. Now I'll switch to Jim. And I really enjoyed your book, and it must be hard for economic analysts right now with this prolonged recession. So what led you to focus on economics and financial analysis and the impact of social trends?
Yeah, well, you know, my family has a long history going back looking at banking and finance. And when we sat around the kitchen table, you know, some families talk about sports. We happen to talk about stocks and the economy. And that's just the way that I grew up. Coming into the investment industry, you're sort of told to take a long-term perspective. But the last few years have been challenging for a lot of people, for investors and advisors alike. How this particular book came into being was really after sitting and reading a lot of the gloom and the doom. I mean, there's a lot of books that are out there that are telling you how bad things are going to be, but not much in the way of giving people some positive direction in terms of how things can get better. And really the purpose of this book is to show people not only how we can rebound, but come out of this better than we went in.
That's always a good message, that there is a possibility that the human enterprise can improve even when things look kind of dire. Your book starts out by really cataloging the doom and gloom, and it's a tough read. The conditions that we're facing in our economy and also in our resources and the climate. So you did a lot of research there to give kind of a snapshot of where we stand in those areas.
Well, you got to be honest about these things. And I think most people have the sense that things have changed over the last decade and the world is really not what it used to be. And at the same time, we still keep going on as if nothing has happened. Really, the phrase that I use for this is that we're all kind of waiting for that Wile E. Coyote moment. You know, when the Roadrunner cartoons, when Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff and realizes he's running on nothing but vapors. And then he sort of has this moment of disbelief before he goes plummeting to the bottom. And there's this sense that we don't really know when that's going to happen, but it could happen. And it could be within the next year or two. It could be within the next 5 or 10. But people are kind of waiting and anticipating for the other shoe to drop.
Yes, that's a great picture, that Wile E. Coyote moment, and none of us want to face that. And it's so easy to kind of be complacent. Well, okay, this is a recession like the last one, and it'll turn around if the government injects enough, or if the private sector works hard enough that somehow we'll just pull it out the old way. So, what's your response to that kind of complacency?
It only works for so long. And what's happened is we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we are bailing people out by institutions that in turn need to be bailed out themselves. And this is really sort of the last bubble, and that bubble, in fact, is government debt at this point. I mean, we're up over $15 trillion worth of government debt at this point, and no clear way of paying that off anytime soon. And in the long term, it could result in inflation. It could result in devaluation of the dollar or higher taxes, none of which are particularly desirable. So what I'm looking at are really ways for people and families to move in a way which will give them a greater degree of stability and resilience during uncertain times.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I know the traditional thinking for families to weather something like this is, okay, get a good education for the kids, hunker down, try to, keep up with the Joneses, but watch your budget and try to hang on to your job. And that's not what you're saying is really going to be our future. So can you tell us a little bit about what the what already some people, some families are making these shifts, and I want to go over a number of these shifts that you describe in your book. Can we start with like the post-nuclear family, the millennial generation?
Sure, sure. Well, I want to talk about first in big terms what seems to be happening right now.
And, yeah, please.
The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And that's a quote from William Gibson, who's a science fiction writer. But it's true. And generally speaking, if you look in the right places, you can get a sense of kind of where things are going. And the big overreaching theme of all of this is that everything old is new again, and that the types of things that you would have learned from your grandparents on how to do things, people are kind of going back and they're relearning these skills again so that they can become more self-sufficient. And this can be from canning to growing your own food to crafts to working from the home and home educating your children, for example. So it's kind of interesting because, what we're finding is that the old ways seem to have value and people are going back to that in times of concern.
That's very interesting. I know you mentioned in your book that a similar kind of thing happened in the 70s and that there's a 50 or 60 year cycle and that it's happening. It's more necessary now. It's a little more voluntary in the 70s. And I know for myself, we did home educate our kids in the 80s. And we also homesteaded for a long time, growing our own organic food up in the Adirondack Hills. And so we were part of that 70s movement. And here, my kids are part of that Gen X millennial transition. And as you say in the book, they're more minimalist. They want to keep things simple. They aren't relying on government or corporation to give them a salary.
Yeah, well, yeah, I was a child of the 70s, and that was sort of the last time that the world was coming to an end, right? And that was the time when my family was growing their own grapes. They got a wood stove for the house, and they, you know, started cooking soup on it. Dad started doing haircuts for the kids in the machine shop. And there is the sense that, you know, maybe if we can't control the economy, at least we can take care of our families, right? And we do that by doing it ourselves. So there's a big uptick in the do-it-yourself movement right now. There's a big uptick in terms of people homesteading. And really the biggest shift here, I think, is a shift away from the household as being perceived as a center for consumption and kind of nudging households and families into becoming centers of self-production, okay? And that's really, really interesting to watch.
Yes, that's a wonderful... It brings real clarity to it. I often complain that, you know, when we talk about the American public, we talk about consumers. And I'm like, well, how did we decide we were consumers? Aren't we people and, you know, producing, serving, believing? And we do a whole lot of other things besides consume, but that's been our economic label for quite a while. So switching the household to a productive center is a great concept. So that dream of home ownership, where can we start there? What's changing there, Jim?
Well, that's changing, and it's really interesting because a lot of the students coming out of college and kids in their 20s are kind of looking at this idea of a home and looking at a mortgage and the American dream and kind of wondering if this is really such a good idea. I mean, they're coming out of school with loads of student loans. They have fairly high levels of unemployment, and the ones that do have jobs really don't have any assurances that they'll be able to keep them for very long. And the result is, for a lot of younger people, is that they're putting off commitments of all sorts, whether it's buying their first house or getting married or having kids. People are somewhat hesitant, as it were, to make long-term personal plans when their personal economics are in flux. And that seems to be what's happening. I mean, you take a look at what's happening in Europe and what's been going on in Europe for decades, is it's not uncommon for families in Italy and France to wait until their late 30s, early 40s before they buy their first home. And we're beginning to see that happening a little bit more in the U.S. as well.
Very interesting. And some of those college grads, that they often move back with their parents to save up money and pay off those loans and, like you said, not make more larger commitments and get in further debt. So it's a very interesting change.
It's a big change. You know, you're seeing, I think, 20% of kids between the age of 18 and 26, roughly speaking, moving back to home to save money, to get through school, to kind of tide them over until they can get their next job. And it's changing the way that families are structured right now. One of the things that I write about is how we're moving from the traditional nuclear family, which is two parents and two or three kids, to something that I refer to as the post-nuclear family. And that's nuclear family that has been mutated into any number of different forms, whether it's families of one, to extended families, to found families of multiple people living under the same roof who might not necessarily be related by genetics or marriage. So I think in order to get through the next few years, we're going to really have to expand our definitions of what we consider to be family.
So what's happening in these different kinds of families? It's not just how many people are in the house, right? There's other changes happening within the whole economic system of that family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of it is economically driven, and I think economics in a lot of ways dictates social custom, and people are just finding it easier to have more people under one roof. I mean, it's just a more traditional, less expensive way of doing things, such that if you take a look at the number of extended families, which includes either more than one generation of adults or grandparents and grandchildren, either one, at this point, that's now around 17 to 18% of the total U.S. population, and it's growing.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we have not only children, but two generations of adults. And do you think that the increase in immigrants that already have that kind of extended cost-saving approach to homes, like from Asia and Hispanic families, often assume that they're going to have multiple generations in their home when they come to America. Is that changing the look of the average family?
Oh, absolutely. And what's interesting, as you say, if you take a look at the Hispanic and the Asian populations, they've had this as a cultural tradition for centuries. And to a certain degree, it's still the norm within Europe as well. I think that we've really had an American exception in terms of being able to support the nuclear family because of the abundance of resources and jobs that we have had right up to the last 10 years or so. So again, economics are dictating family structures at this point, and as it relates to homes and as it relates to households, I think people are going to find that some of these big homes that they've been buying over the last few years are maybe useful, but in an unintended sense, in that they can hold more family members than any of the homes that they've owned previously. So I think you're going to have a lot more families living together under one roof in one space and sharing responsibilities.
Yeah, I can imagine the American pattern we've always, you know, it's always go west or go south. There's always more space for this nuclear family to leave the parents, but we've hit the Pacific and we've hit the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, we no longer have unlimited resources the way we thought we did 100 years ago. And so that's really making a difference for families. We're almost on a break, but I want to talk more about what you call gender blending and more discreet consumption and some other fascinating concepts that you have in your book. So keep listening about how to build your resilience in your family with our guest, James Lee, author of Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. So we'll be back in a moment.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? 5-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's R-A-N-D-Y-R-O-L-F-E.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We're talking about the resilient family with James H. Lee, who's a financial advisor and market analyst who also looks at social trends and is a futurist. And he's written a wonderful book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. And we've been talking about how we can get really weighed down with the doom and gloom about the economics of the country and the world and the climate change and the shrinking resources and various other problems. But the future is really in the hands of grassroots movements. It has to come from the people. The corporations and the government aren't going to bail us out. We can help ourselves. And so we're looking at some of the trends that are already happening and bringing the future here. And we've talked about the post-nuclear families, the American, uniquely American pattern of two parents and two and a half kids is not happening anymore. And people are waiting longer to start families, longer to commit to a home, if ever, and not committing to a lifetime at any particular career either. So, Jim, let's talk some more about the kinds of families that are happening and what you call gender blending. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, gender blending is a term that I coined up a few years ago. I am in my 40s now, and say, beginning around 2002, 2003, I noticed a little shift. When I was talking to our friends who are starting their own families, and what would happen is, my guy friends would come up to me and say, "Oh, by the way, I just want to let you know that we're pregnant." And it wasn't my wife is pregnant or my wife is expecting. It was sort of brought in this collective we, okay? And that was kind of an interesting shift that I hadn't seen, you know, a few years before then. And what's happening at this point is that you have women who have gone to work now, and they are salary winners, and in many cases they're out earning their spouses at the workplace. But you're also seeing men adapting more and more traditional roles of a wife within a family. And that would include taking care of the kids, homeschooling the kids, taking them to soccer practice, and also taking care of their parents as well, just in terms of elder care. And it's kind of interesting because when you look at the big picture of all of this, that tends to happen during periods of economic hardship. I mean, people have to pitch in any way that they can when times are tough. So you have more of a generalization of family roles during economic contraction. And you have an increase in specialization of family roles and gender roles during times of economic expansion. So in the current contraction, what I'm seeing is that women are taking more men's work and men are taking more women's work.
It's fascinating. Many of us think of that as, you know, women's liberation. We're going to get the men to do more of the chores and we're going to go out and make the money. But the economics makes that into a necessity.
It is. And, on one hand, you can call it women's liberation. I don't know what I would call it for the guys. Two things that I've noticed are happening. One is men are getting rated better at parenting skills than they were a decade or two ago. And the second is there are a lot fewer rounds of golf being played in the U.S. And that's a big problem for the golf industry because the guys are staying at home.
That was interesting how there are many fewer golf courses being built. I know there was a huge growth, I guess it was in the 90s, of golf courses being built all through the South and even in the Northeast and the West. And now it's shrinking again.
No one has the time or the money. And that kind of brings us into the concept of discrete consumption, which is also very interesting because there's been such an uprising against the 1%, okay? And there's, I think, a fairly significant backlash in the country against conspicuous consumption because times are difficult for so many people. And the result is that the people with the financial means are beginning to tone back on how they display their wealth. And discrete consumption is about spending money, you know, as well as you can, but being much more careful about your expenditures and being much less public about your expenditures. So the shift in status items is away from the brand names and from the things that everyone knows are expensive towards purchasing artisanal or handmade goods with a little bit more of a story, a little bit more of a connection to the maker of the product. And it gives the owner satisfaction that only they know how much they spent or what something is worth. It's no longer advertised in public the way that it used to be. And I think that's very interesting.
Yes. Actually, my husband and I were talking about the fact that the super wealthy today are not building the kind of castles they did 30 years ago, and the castles are going begging for buyers that were built back then because even the wealthy are downsizing and not being quite so conspicuous and realizing that there's other more useful things they can do with their funds.
Yeah, I mean, or I think a lot of the, you know, a lot of the McMansions that have been bought and sold are going to become multifamily complexes, as it were. The most interesting part of the design and architecture movement right now is not, you know, these big sprawling houses, but actually the tiny homes, you know, homes that are less than 800 square feet in size. That's what's attracting a lot of the top designers today is figuring out how to do more with less. And that's a very interesting trend.
It certainly is. And I wanted, you talked about the chores, all the functions in a home from parenting to earning the money needed and doing household, that the genders are being more generalist rather than specialist. And that works in careers too. It was fascinating in your book that you were saying in high times there was a luxury of becoming a specialist and doing that for 40 years and retiring with a pension. That's not true in these days.
Yeah. The big shift here, we've actually sort of had three different career paradigms within just the last 50 years. And the earliest one, which you know, people remember, is the career ladder. You know, basically, what happens is you leave school, you work for an employer, and you stay with them for 40 years, and you hope to climb up the ladder and advance over the course of your career. And you might get stuck in a middle run somewhere, but generally speaking, you stick to where you started. And sometime around the 1980s, the baby boomers, I think, shifted that paradigm a little bit to what I refer to as a career lattice, which means people are still climbing upward, but they might make a lateral move mid-career every 5 or 10 years to a different organization, but performing at a similar type of function. What seems to be happening now is really more of a patchwork crazy quilt so far as careers are involved. And that's what happens when people stitch together together a number of different work opportunities in a way that provides them with flexibility and covers their personal needs. So not only are people not just working one job for the course of the career, but they're stitching together several different careers and working them all at the same time. And that's another type of generalization. People are going to have to do more and more different types of things in order to give them options and give them a certain degree of economic stability.
So then it's not just about serial careers. It's actually having a number of different things going on at one time. Is that right?
Parallel careers all happening at the same time. And if one of them goes obsolete, you've already got one to fall back on.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a plan B?
It's a plan B. And it's a little bit more demanding. I think it can be a little bit more stressful. But it gives you a little bit more honest stability in terms of giving you more skills and more talents to work with. I mean, what we've seen over the last few years is you know, first the disappearance of jobs, then the disappearance of the workplace with telecommuting, okay, and then a disappearance of the work week, right? You know, the 9-to-5 job is becoming a little bit more the exception than the rule anymore. And
right.
People are pretty much always on. Okay. So it's interesting to watch at this point. What's also interesting is that there seems to be a blurring of the lines between working, learning, and just plain goofing off. And sometimes all three things happen at the same time. You know, it's a little bit hazy. But I think ultimately by, you know, moving to this paradigm of patchwork careers, people will be able to have a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more control over their lives. Now, if they're hanging back on the old paradigm of the career ladder, you know, that's going to be difficult. That's going to be really difficult.
Yeah, I can see how it might be more stressful pursuing a couple of different things, but you also have the confidence that if one fails, the other is still there, and a bigger sense of control over your own family's destiny, perhaps.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes just from being self-employed. And I think what will start to happen, we haven't really seen this yet, but we may start to see more kids getting involved with their parents in terms of bringing back the family business. Okay, so
yeah, that would be exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So let's switch a little bit, because you have a very interesting part in your book about finances and developing more barter, local currencies, do-it-yourself banking. So can you tell us a little about all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Goodness, where do you want to start? I mean, each topic is sort of its own thing.
Well,
you
mentioned in the book some communities that are using a more or less barter system or a localized currency, and there was one that even used work hours as a currency.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, a lot of this is really looking at the local and the physical versus the digital and the distant, okay? So part of what a lot of resilient communities are doing is they're trying to rebuild their local economies. And one of the best ways to do that is to create what they call a local currency. Now, there are now about 100 different alternative currencies to the U.S. dollar within the U.S. at this time, which is very interesting. They tend to be very small, very dispersed, but many of them are only useful in one or two towns. For example, Baltimore now has something called the B-note. And what the B-note is it's a printed dollar that is only useful for locally owned businesses within the city of Baltimore. And how it works is you go to a bank and you get one Baltimore B note for 90 cents worth of U.S. dollars. Okay, so it's kind of like once you convert to B notes, you get a 10% discount off of anything that's purchased locally within Baltimore. So you go to a local coffee shop, you spend your B note. The coffee shop now has this B note that they can't necessarily put in a bank to earn interest on. It only has value when they in turn choose to spend it somewhere else. So they might go to a pastry shop where they get their biscuits and spend the B note, who in turn finds another local business to spend the money. And what it does is it creates a closed circuit within the local economy, and it supports privately owned businesses, and it supports businesses of people that you personally know. And it's a really interesting phenomenon that seems to help.
Yeah, so it creates an incentive to keep the productivity and the money circulating within the local community.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's supporting people that you know. And I think really the biggest opportunity out of all of this restructuring that we're seeing is the opportunity to rebuild these casual social networks and rebuild social capital. In essence, rebuild this collective sense of trust.
I love that idea because it is so ephemeral right now. There's a lot of distrust because people are feeling competitive and put upon and disadvantaged, and the idea that you can take action, be proactive in your community to take more control over what's going on around you it's got to feel good to these communities to be able to do that.
It does. And, one of the best things that I did just for myself this year, as a result of working on this book is I started up a community farmers market. And, it's, five blocks from my house, and it's kind of turning into a nice little social event. I have, four or five different farmers and pastry shops and bread makers and so forth getting together. And the neighbors come out and they hang out and they fondle the produce and they talk about, recipes. And it's really turning it into just a really nice way of shopping. And you get to meet the person making your food and you have assurances that what you're buying is what you think you're buying because you know where it came from and you know who made it.
Yeah, I've taught nutrition for many years, and one of the things I always say is if you're not sure and confident about your food, talk to the person who grew it, and it's going to have to be local. That's exciting. The markets are a place where people have met for centuries, and now we just go to a Walmart or a Wegmans, and you don't know anybody. So it's quite a change in cultural shift, which, like you said, can be a very good thing. So good things can come out of this. We're coming up on another break, Jim, but I want to talk more about the different generational reactions and the impact of the digital world, because we're talking about very physical needs like the food and the shelter, but there's a whole nother area affected by the global communication. So when we come back from the break, I want to talk about that some more, okay?
Sure.
All right, so we'll be back in a moment.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters, whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance. Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living.
To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RANDYROLFE.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back. We're talking about the resilient family, and it reminds me of if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And my guest today is really showing families how to be part of the solution. My guest is James H. Lee, and he has a wonderful book called Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. And he really, he first outlines what is, you know, the facts about our economy and global warming and, reduced and shrinking resources and changes in the family and in health and in the elderly too. Fascinating about that. But he spends most of the book showing all the great trends that are out there about how families are shifting into more self-reliant, more trusting, more local, more community-based, and more creative and productive lives. So I'm excited to have you on the show, Jim. And I wanted to talk some more about the way different generations are responding to the imperatives that are out there now.
Yeah, well, it's interesting listening to people of different ages respond to my book, right?
Yes.
And I'm finding that a lot of young people just say, this is amazing stuff. This is just right on target. And then you have people my age that are saying, this is interesting. This seems to be happening, but I don't really know where this is going. And then you have people who may be in their 70s or 80s who get some of it, but they don't quite know how it all fits together. And what I think is happening is that if we look at all of the expectations that we had when we were growing up, that the people who were born prior to World War II really won't have to make a lot of changes. Okay? I mean, that's the last generation where you're going to have full pensions, you're going to have full Social Security, and you had full lifetime employment. Okay, so
right.
I don't think that they're going to have to make a lot of changes because they will still have a lot of the social support programs that were promised. The baby boomers are in a slightly different situation just because there are so darn many of them, okay? And
right.
A lot of them have, they've saved for themselves over the course of the last few years, but the last decade, stocks have been flat. Bonds really aren't generating much in the way of interest or income. And they're realizing that the traditional concept of retirement just isn't happening anymore. So, you know, we're changing away from the concept of traditional retirement to what I call retooling, which is just doing something different, okay, but still earning a living. Maybe not getting paid what you used to get paid, but doing something hopefully because you like it, enjoy it, and you're getting some incidental cash flow coming out of that as well. The people in my generation, I'm flat in the middle of Generation X, we're seeing them shift lot more towards do-it-yourself, towards homesteading, towards starting up your own businesses. There are just a ton of entrepreneurs in their 30s and 40s right now, in part because the baby boomers are still there, and there's really no place for them to move up in the workplace. So they're moving out, and they're doing their own things at this point. And then you have the Generation Y in the millennials. And these are the people that were born, roughly speaking, between 1980 and 2000. And these folks are what I'm calling the post-consumer generation. And they're walking away from a lot of the things that we considered important because they just don't need them anymore. So if you take a look at what the average college student has on their laptop, it's their movie collection, it's their music collection, it's all of their books, it's all of their games. It's all on that one laptop, or in some cases even cell phone. So what they're realizing is that they don't need as much stuff anymore. They don't need a big house, and without the big house, they don't necessarily need the mortgage. They don't necessarily need to have a car. So all of a sudden, they don't need quite as much as they did before. And what they're looking for in a job isn't so much stability, but they're looking for work opportunities that enable them to learn. And they're looking for jobs that offer kind of a combination of flexibility, freedom, and fun. And it's a very, very different paradigm, but it's only possible because their financial needs, in many cases, may be lower, with the exception of the student loans. But generally speaking, they're increasingly hesitant to take on debt.
That's fascinating, yes, that's a real change. And you've covered the four generations, and quite amazing that where we might have a wall, which I do, of my favorite videos, they have them all right on their laptop. They've downloaded them, or they can find them on Netflix, and they just don't need that bookcase. And symptomatic of a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I have another wall of photos of my kids, and they have them all on their laptop when they do have kids.
To go. Yeah, it's going to be hard for me to get rid of my books. But I can feel it coming.
Mm. Yeah, my husband has a Kindle, but I really appreciated getting your book in physical form. So with these different age groups, you did mention how the digital world is really being embraced by the millennials because it's always been there. Like for me, the telephone's always been there, but to my grandmother, it was new. And now for them, the whole digital world is an assumption that they know is there. Right. And it's really changed their lives. And it's a little bit reassuring that the war generation probably won't need to adapt totally to this new digital world.
Right. Yeah,
so that's somewhat
really seems like the world is moving at two different speeds. You have the digital and you have the physical. And the digital-related jobs are the ones that can happen anywhere and any time. And the physical jobs are still going to be here, okay? You know, you're still going to have to show up at the store when the store is open and you have customers. You're not going to be able to outsource your lawn mowing to someone in India. They're going to have to be someone in your neighborhood. What I think is happening right now is that with an increase in the digital, people are kind of going back to the physical just for creature comforts because it feels good and because it feels familiar. And that's really interesting to watch the balance and the interplay between the two.
Yeah, it seems like we're really exploring in the dark so far on how that balance is going to work out. There's new things on the horizon every day as far as integrating our communication. But then, as you've pointed out so well, all these trends to actually localize and get more community focused for the actual physical needs for human companionship and cooperation and food and clothing. So can we talk some about the craft music movement of people making things for themselves and kind of rediscovering the joy of using something you've made? Like, I remember my mother said that when she was growing up, she had homemade cookies all the time, and she thought a store-bought cookie was fantastic. And now we're going back the other way of saying, wait a minute, the cookies I buy in the store just aren't the same as the ones I make with my grandchild. So yeah. Can you tell us more about that, the crafts movement?
Well, I think started as a result of the recession and people just saving money by doing it themselves. But then they just started to enjoy it, and they got comfortable with the idea that they no longer needed to go somewhere else. And with the internet, it made it a lot easier to learn some of these skills that have been forgotten over the course of the last few years. So what seems to be happening right now is that we're seeing a slow shift in terms of what are valued socially, away from what you have or own towards what you can do or make. And that's what's cool now. It's not about buying something. It's about doing it yourself and having that story. And one of the places where I like to go shopping now is on Etsy Online, which is all handcrafted goods. And I can find stuff there that I can't find at the jewelry store or anywhere else. And there's another site called Artfire, where you have vendors that are making their own stuff. They're selling it directly to the consumer, and it's like a giant crafts fair. And some people are actually making a living with digital shop fronts now, selling their own jewelry, their own artwork, their own, you name it. And people are buying it, and it's really interesting.
So what are those websites again? Artfire, and what was the first one, Jim?
Artfire is one, and the other one is Etsy. That's E-T-S-Y.
And the people that are selling things they've made themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're making a living out of it in many cases.
That's very exciting. And I think that, like you said, the recession may have made people more likely to do things for themselves, but now they're rediscovering the joy of actually meeting their needs without going through the whole financial system of earning the money and then going and spending the money somewhere on something that you want. Instead, you just make it.
And that's where the bartering comes in, is, again, instead of people spending money, what's happening is they're going online, sites like swapit.com is one, and they're swapping books that they have already read or music that they've read, or they're swapping services, as is the case for time banks. And they're finding ways of getting what they need without necessarily going through the financial system. And we're going to see more and more of that if things destabilize further.
Yeah, and it seems like, 20 years ago, you might wish you could get into some kind of barter community, but with the internet, you can find those people in your local community who are into this or pioneering it, or even have a global community where you can get homemade clothes from Oregon.
Right, right.
So that's very exciting. So we just have a couple more minutes. I want to be sure and get your information out there. The name of your book, of course, is Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life, James H. Lee. And how can people reach you for either financial advice or some futurist predictions? Or
sure.
Can you give some contact information, Jim?
You bet, yeah. Yeah, I've been spending the last year or so just working on the book, so I will be starting up my own investment management firm this coming fall. But in the meanwhile, people can follow me on my blog, which is resilience-economics.com. And I'm also tweeting on Twitter as well, and my Twitter handle is J-H-L-I-N-D-E, short for James H. Lee in Delaware. And people can follow me there also if they like. And the book, of course, is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, both in print and digital formats.
Fabulous. And so your website, is it Resilient or Resilience Economics?
It's Resilience-Economics. And it's about sustainability and investment strategy. So one post might be on how to start a farmer's market, and the other post might be investing in nanotechnology. I mean, it really runs the full gamut.
Oh, it sounds fascinating, and you have such a grasp of all the good things that are happening in response to changes that, and things do change. And I love that you have a broad historical perspective on the whole thing as well. So thank you so much for being our guest on Family First. Any last-minute 10-second advice to families?
Well, no, to sort of summarize it all, there's the lyrics from a band called REM, which just says that it's the end of the world as we know it, but we'll feel fine. And I think in the end, it'll all be okay.
Ah, yes, I love that line. It's in your book. That's great. So thanks again for being our guest. That's James H. Lee, futurist and economic analyst and author of Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed Family First. Please tune in to our program every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, to join your host, Randy Rolfe, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The weekend is here. Enjoy it with your family. And we hope to see you here next week.